He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
A warning, this podcast contains strong language and references to self-harm and alcohol.
Nau mai, haere mai, piki mai, kake mai, kia ora, and welcome to 30 with me, Guyon Espinner. 30 minutes, one guest, no cuts. What we record is what you get. Today, the remarkable life of Dave Latelli. He's the son of a gang boss and nearly became a gangster himself. Now, he's the go-to guy on how to deal with some of our most serious social problems. This is a personal transformation story. Dave Latelli tipped the scales at more than 200 kilograms. And now, through his Butterbean Motivation Program, he helps others break free from the shackles of obesity. The former boxer and league player is setting up food banks and free gyms, and he's not done yet. So let's start the clock, 30 minutes with Dave Latelli. Kia ora, welcome Dave Latelli, welcome to 30.
Kia ora Bruno, thanks for having me.
Let's start with what you've just been up to in the last couple of days. You run these walk uphill sort of motivational walks, and often people from literally all walks of life come. I understand it was quite a profound experience a couple of days back. Take me there.
Yeah, it was a special moment. We were up at Mount Eden. It was pouring rain on 7 a.m. on what day was it, Good Friday. And, you know, there was a lot of us there. And I love those walks because that's how we started. I started my journey, you know, getting off the bed and going for a walk at One Tree Hill. You know, it's massively overweight and extremely depressed, wanting to end my life. But while I was walking these maunga, I wasn't thinking about life, and you know, I was just thinking about getting up the hill and how hard it was and all these things. But you know, so I love going back there, and that one was amazing. I mean, the setting, that it stopped raining as soon as we walked. We started our walk and had people from all walks of life. So you know, you had people from LinkedIn, you had chairmen there, and then you had people you know, overcoming addictions. You had, you know, former and current gang members. We had Grace Foundation there, which is something my sister started. Up the top, the sun was shining. We did a little workout, and then we had people that were just doing their own walk, and they saw, and they could see and sense how special it was, and they joined in. And then some people saw us, you know, performing. Grace Foundation had performed the haka to us, and BBM replied, and it was just a special moment, bro. And you know, I spoke to some of the Grace Foundation people there, and you know, my memory of Mount Eden as a kid was playing in the playground there before or after prison visits. You know, and a lot of their memories is looking out of a frosted glass from Mount Eden, you know, and then to be there free and doing something, you know, special. And it's just showing them, hey, you know, it's possible and that we're all destined for something better.
That's really interesting. You, of course, are quite close to Mount Eden prison there, but this is at a time when your father was in prison.
Yeah, so I mean, there was many times with my, either it was my father or uncles or family friends that we'd visit in Mount Eden. I remember visiting my uncle Bonzo there, who's passed away now, and we, you know, it was a big thing. You know, we'd go and we'd get some, you know, back then it was like, you know, packs of fruit from the dairy. To take it up to the prison, and you could take food in back in those days, and we'd look forward to him bringing out the chocolate, you know. But the memory, the good part of the visits was not necessarily going and visiting. It was because you get treated like a dog going, even when you're visiting prison. But it was playing on that playground. They had an awesome flying fox there. And anyone that's visited Mount Eden prison as a kid, you'd remember that playground because we all went there.
Your early years are pretty extraordinary. I read your book, No Excuses, and one story that really resonated with me was your first experience with the police at Christmas time when they came into your house. Take me back there.
Yeah, it's crazy because it is a memory. I was only young. A lot of the memories as a kid, I guess when you have bad memories, you block them out. But I remember that quite vividly. It was a late afternoon, we're all in our pajamas, and I was wondering why, you know. And then the police were raiding our house. This was in Hamilton. There was some burglaries that had happened up in Auckland, and a lot of the stuff was brought back down to our place in Hamilton and wrapped up as Christmas presents. So that was my first memory of the police was them confiscating all of this, my presents.
So the police took your Christmas presents?
And it's, you know, now I know you know, being older, I understand that they weren't stealing them. They were confiscating.
What it looked like as a kid, though.
I hated the police from that day on. From that day, I hated the police with everything I had. I hated them. And you can imagine why. Like, as a kid, you don't understand what's happening. You just see the police taking all your stuff. And I've spoken to Costa last year. I said, how can we minimize the trauma on children when these things happen? Because it's not our fault, right? It's not our fault. But if that's our first introduction to the system, no wonder we hate it. You know, no wonder.
Yeah, you talked about a couple of things there. You're pretty dark on corrections. You mentioned that before. And where does that come from? Is that just come from the treatment that you saw as a visitor to prison?
Yeah, look, you know, I didn't like police for a long time, but I work alongside the police now. I understand that they're a community group doing good work, just like us. There are some scumbags in there, but like in any, that's life. But I'll never like corrections, never. I hate them with everything I have. Just with the experience of visiting prisons a lot of my life, you just get treated like an animal. And you know, you're not the criminal, you know, but you get treated literally like a dog, you know, especially if you have family with that are quite high ranking.
And we'll come back to that because we'll talk about your sister's experience a little bit later in the interview. But yours is essentially a young life as a young boy. This was heavily a gang. Affiliations. In fact, your father was what I believe the president of the Auckland chapter of the Mongol mob at just 19. So you were heavily involved in that area. This was your life, right?
Well, we were around it. You know, the crazy thing is my dad came from a good family. So, you know, I guess in one way we were lucky that it wasn't steeped in generations of our family. It was really only my father and one, his younger brother, that went down that path. The rest of our family chose a totally different path. But, you know, I saw it. I saw a lot. And, you know, I always say to people, to parents, you know, to be careful what your kids see. We think they don't see anything, but they see it all. It came to play its part later on in life when I went through some tough times.
Must have had a huge impact on you when your father was sentenced and went away to prison. I think that resulted in you being whangaied out, did it to Australia, effectively?
Yeah, I don't remember much from that time. All I do remember is my mum coming home panicking. You know, and 99.999% of the time in that life, it's the woman left to sweep up the pieces, and my poor mum. She came home in a panic and just packing stuff and cursing my dad. And I didn't really understand what was going on. I remember trying to cheer my mum up, you know, because she was upset. And I was only young. So, you know, to try and cheer her up, I poured slime in my hair, you know, like, don't know, but just added to the chaos. And then I had to, my father, who, you know, they did their best to try keep us away, you know, and he was worried as the male, what would happen if I stayed. So he wanted to send me to Australia with his parents, my grandparents. It was actually meant to be me and my younger sister, my late sister Vicky, that were meant to go over, but my mum ended up, you know, kidnapping my sister so she could keep her.
Let's talk about gangs, because everyone's talking about gangs at the moment. The government's got their view on what they're going to do. So we'll talk about that. But why do people join gangs?
Oh man, it's like in some cases, why not? You know, like what people don't need to understand is, if you're living in a deprived area, you've got no money, you've got nothing. Your idea of success, like all of ours, while we're here to earn money, your idea of success is having material things and having money, being comfortable. And the only people in your area with those things are drug dealers and gang members. You know, I don't blame them for wanting to aspire to that. You know, it's that's what we have to deal with, is the whole poverty. You know, it's like, and gangs aren't nothing new. If you go right, I forgot, Kerry Woodham sent me this post. It was a text from some old school English writer, I forgot it. But it was basically on the old school, you know, the childhood kids gangs back in England, you know. And it was, their whole thinking was, I don't have it, you do, so I'm taking it. And that's, you know, centuries ago. I mean, it's still now, and so we still haven't dealt with it. So to me, that, you know, that's why these kids are joining, and that's why I get so frustrated when people who make it out, and not just sports stars, I'm talking business people, people that make it out and don't come back to show these kids it's possible. There's some kids we work with who wouldn't even think it's possible to have a nice car without being a drug dealer. You know, it wouldn't even enter their mind that they
could
have it.
So you think it's that, it's providing for that stuff more than or as well as that sense of belonging? Because from an outsider, and I certainly didn't, I grew up at the opposite end of the spectrum than you, but I kind of look at it and think maybe it's the belonging.
Yeah, I mean, there is the belonging part of it as well. You're part of something. It's like what we've created in BBM. We belong to it. We're a part of it. So it's definitely, we all want to, we have this innate, you know, we all want to belong to something. But if you want to, you know, cut down these gang numbers, you know, you cannot imprison your way out of it. You can't imprison your way out of poverty. You can't reduce gang numbers by throwing more people in prison, because prison's the biggest breeding ground for gangs. So we have to deal with the root issue here.
Well, let's talk about what the government is doing, because effectively that's kind of what the government is doing. They're saying we'll lock you up if you wear your patches in public, and we'll suppress gangs and we'll make it an aggravating factor at sentencing, so no matter what your crime, if you're a gang member, you'll get longer prison sentences. What do you think of what you've heard about what the government's doing? Do you think it's going to work?
Oh, it definitely won't work. It just will drive more people underground. It will drive more. It'll make people hate them even more. And I think it'll increase gang numbers. You know, you get this because people unite against a common cause of hating this government. You know, it's going to cause more people to join. But again, it doesn't deal with the root problem here. You know, it doesn't deal. You've got to, if you want to break these cycles, when you've got kids joining gangs and being patched at 9 years old, you know, throwing someone in prison doesn't solve anything. You know, getting these kids into boot camps, taking them out of their situations and throwing them back doesn't change anything. You've got to walk alongside these families long term, support them long term, and that's not popular. You know, saying, okay, we're going to invest in something and walk alongside these families so that life's better for the grandkids.
I was reading that 80 to 90%, so nearly 90% of mongrel mob and black power ex-state wards. Mm. And that's the path your dad followed, right?
Yeah, my dad...
state ward?
I think he became a state ward of the state at, I think, 9. Yeah, he'd burnt down his school. And, he went and he was in there for quite a few years. And that's where his life just took a, you know, down that path. He went for a long time.
Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it? The 9 out of 10 of those gangs are state wards. So that's where your problem starting, if you like.
100%. And so if you've got that, and then you think that throwing the adults, more adults in prison, is going to solve anything, it's not going to do anything. You know, it's such a backwards way of thinking, and it's just to appease the right wing voter base. If you've got to, and it's like all governments, all parties need to get together and say, okay, this is the strategy. Let's come up with a strategy, a long-term strategy where it's working with community, business and government long-term, you know, to turn things around. Because this is a generational issue. It takes a generation to change it. What they're doing is just going to make it worse.
You talked briefly about boot camps. I mean, the government is introducing these military-style boot camps in mid-year. It's a funny word, boot camps, isn't it? Because I think I know
that's
this.
What we do.
Some of the work that you do, you describe in that way. Is it something you want to be part of? Do you want to say, look, I'll put my hand up and be a provider of this sort of thing?
Well, whether it's us, it has to be a community base. You know, what they've done by putting Kainga, who is it, Oranga Tamariki involved, I mean, that's a disgrace. You know,
why?
Because they can't keep up with the job they're doing now. You know, they're always in turmoil. It's got to be community-led with government services and social services wrapped around those people, not the other way around. It's just not going to work. You know, these kids are used to being treated like shit. They're used to it. So what's treating them like even more shit, taking them out of the place, treating them harshly, what's that going to do? They're used to it, you know. But what they're not used to is love, you know. Of course, you've got to train them hard like we do with our rangatahi programs. We train them hard, but we also support them. There's everything else that's wrapped around that. It's not just getting sheltered at and made to climb mountains and just, you know, abused mentally. That doesn't work because they're used to it.
And they're not going to get that love from Oranga Tamariki in your
life. Of course not. Like, it's not going to happen. I like the idea of the boot camp part of it, so long as it's done the way we do it, where it's wrapped around with all the community support, with all that wraparound support, and it's done with love. You know, not the way that they're going
to
do it.
So you're putting your hand up today to be part of it?
Oh, I've already told them that I'd be keen to be a part of it. But, the problem with these people down in Wellington, these bureaucrats and politicians, they don't listen. They think they know best. They think they can run everything from Wellington. It doesn't work that way. You know, it's got any social issue, you will find a community group down there at the bottom, at the grassroots, the flax roots, having an impact with next to no resource. If you just resource those groups properly, imagine the impact. You know, but that's not the way they think.
Let's change tack. A lot of your experience and a lot of the work that you're doing is based on weight and food. We'll get to some of the solutions soon, but what's your own experience been with weight and weight gain and obesity?
Oh, well, I weighed well over 210 kilos. We've helped people that are, close to 300, some close to 400 kilos. The weight is like a byproduct of everything else that's going wrong in your life, so you've got to deal with that. Same thing like what we talk about with the youth crime, same thing, you've got to deal with the root issue. So what we do, it's based on, Te Whare Te Pawha or Whanau Whale. We get all these, you get everything right, you get your whānau, your spiritual, your physical, your mental, you get it all right. Because health is not just boot camps, it's not just exercise, it's everything. You've got to take the family along with you. And that's what we do, that's our model.
But it's movement that seems so important to you. Like you just literally, like as we started this interview, right? It's one foot, ahead of the other, walking up the hill, starting, right?
Even just last night, sitting at home. And my life's a lot better than what it was, but I still get down. I still oh man, the weight of everything is on my shoulders. I've got just thinking, what's our next move? This new government's rubbish, we're not going to get any support, so I'm stressed about it. So when I think like that, I went to Camp Sladen, I went for a walk, a real hard one, just like 1,000 steps, and I'm trying to do it in 20 minutes. So in that 20 minutes, I'm not thinking about anything but getting up, so it just gives your brain a chance to rest. You feel better after. You have the natural endorphins of exercise running through your body, so you feel happier, and you feel a sense of accomplishment, and your brain had a chance to rest. And that's the important part.
Let's just rewind there a bit, because you said you still feel down quite a bit. I mean, that seems surprising to me from this distance, because I look at you and see all you've achieved, and you know, I read your book and see your programs and things. Mm. But you're still someone who gets the black dog coming at them every now and again.
Oh, I think you never really get over it. You get better at dealing with it, but when I was 21, it's when it started, when my dad went back in jail, and I got just super, I was just went right off the rails, and I ended up, putting a knife into my chest. I didn't want to be here. There's been plenty of times through my journey where, I've contemplated doing something to myself. I've thought, man, what's the most pain-free way? I think at one time in a bath, I think, what if I just take some pills and just drown? It's always, you just get better at dealing with it, I guess. But still now, like the pressures of everything we do, it weighs really heavily on me. And then, not spending as much time as you should with your family, because of everything you do in the community. My own relationship with my family, with my mum and dad's not there at the moment. So, I've got that playing on my mind. It's just lots going on. That's life, so yeah. But I don't think it ever really goes. You just sort of get better at dealing with it.
But the role of sport, movement, exercise, you've touched on that a number of times, and for yourself, whether it was rugby league, which I think you saw as a path out, and then the boxing, which really kind of led into Brown Buttervine motivation. So sport, movement, just getting out there, exercise has been a big part of your mental health as well, right?
100%. Exercise saved my life. That's why I don't exercise for the physical benefits. I do it for the mental benefits, purely just because you feel better after. Sometimes I got to taper it because you can't continually just smash yourself. with exercise, you've got to actually deal with the issues, you know. So, but I always feel better after, and that's the. And then, you know, like, I don't drink, so my going to the pub is training with my mates, with good people around you. You know, you just feel, you know, feel a lot better.
When was the last time you had a drink?
Oh, a few years ago now, I can't remember. It was a while ago, probably my wedding.
But you gave up totally.
I gave up totally only because I wasn't a very good drinker, and my tolerance for idiots goes down to zero. So it's, I just couldn't afford to get into trouble. So yeah, I just stopped. I had to stop it.
I ran into Rob Campbell the other night.
Oh yes,
he's a good friend of yours, and he's reached the top in many ways, in right from business to bureaucracy, and had a big role in the health ministry, of course. He said you took a drink out of his hand, and
yeah, it's funny. We're at a he was the chairman of Sky City when I met him, and he was I was there for a talk, and he was with Kevin Mealamu, so I wanted a selfie with Kev. I get my selfie, Kev leaves, and Rob says to me, my wife's really worried about my health. And I said to you, well, you should put down that wine and the sausage roll, and we'll start tomorrow. And we did. You know, and he's done really well. He lost like 40 kilos from when we met him. Stopped drinking, you know, even turned vegan. So now he drives an electric vehicle, so it really worked with him.
What do you make of the role of that alcohol plays in society? I mean, a lot of the sport that we've just been talking about, you know, you go to any game and the alcohol producers are the sponsors, plays a massive part in New Zealand culture. Do you look at that and have your doubts about whether that's a good idea?
Yeah, I have my doubts about anything that's bad for us, and that we're, you know, I talk from our community perspective, and we represent, you know, deprived areas. The areas that we work in throughout the country, any of these deprived areas are overwhelmed with everything bad for us, alcohol stores, you know, vapes, crap food, gambling, it's all there at you know, fingertips, it's right there, you know, but you know, they're let to just rape and pillage our communities and not doing anything to help, you know, so who's, you just got to follow the money. Who's making all the money here? How are these spaces being allowed to open? You know, a liquor store on every corner. You know, and it's funny because you go to Rimuera, you go to a fancy area, and it looks very inviting. You know, it's got wine tasting all the time, and it's very nice. But you head out south, and it's like visiting Mount Eden.
They're all gated up, eh?
Yeah.
They look like drug dealers. I suppose they are in some ways. I mean, they're dealing a drug, but yeah. They look pretty confrontational, don't they?
Yeah, it's just it's a disgrace what they're being allowed to do to our communities, to our most vulnerable, you know, without really no care. You know, instead of sponsoring all these sports teams, they should be putting money back into the community, you know, and sponsoring healthy lunches and sponsoring, you know, after school programs and things like this.
Mm. We've talked a bit about money. You seem quite entrepreneurial in your own way, or at least you've always got these schemes that you're setting up. And I look back on your background, and you had sort of these two uncles who are entrepreneurial in their own way, right? One that you mentioned was a bank robber. The other rose to be, what, head of restaurant brands or very senior in that
company. Yeah, he was the boss of restaurant brands over here.
Yeah, so that must have been an interesting sort of contrast.
Yeah, I had a family filled with leaders. You know, just some chose the wrong path and some chose, you know, my uncle, he chose the right path. So I had different role models and I really... The early part of my life, I latched on to my Uncle Ulla, who ended up, he was at the time the boss of Duty Free Shoppers, and I really role modelled myself off him. I wanted to be a businessman, I wanted to have money, so I studied really hard. But then I was also seeing a lot of stuff from my uncle and my parents. So when times got tough for me, I chose, you know, the wrong path as well. So yeah, I had both sides of the rails, or the tracks, I guess, to learn from.
Yeah, and you combined those in Australia in some ways, didn't you? Because you'd set up a supermarket, but then that went south, and you sort of became involved in the gang world over there, or close to the sort of underworld in Australia.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't talk about it too much, but I had like those a couple of businesses over in Australia, and I thought, man, I've made it. I've done it here. I've broken the cycle. And I was so proud of myself, but I just had no idea how to handle money. You know, and we speak at a lot of schools now, a lot of deprived areas, they do not teach financial literacy because they have no time and resource, but all the rich schools do. And I had no idea. And I just totally, totally fucked it all up and lost everything, including my family. And I just got up to a lot of no good. And that's where I always say, be careful what your kids see, because I thought to myself, there's no way that I'm going to go back to not being able to give my kids things. It's not happening. And so, you know, whatever I do, I try my hardest at, and I dove straight into that life.
And you had a mate who helped you out, didn't you? That's pretty important, isn't it? The second chance.
Yeah.
For you. And I know you've done this yourself now, and repaying it. But, you know, with Manu Vatavai, for example, but people who've made a mistake and you go back and give them a second chance, because that's what you were given, right?
Yeah, my good friend David Higgins, who I grew up with, I've known him for like 30 years. And he brought me back here, he had to pay for me business class. I couldn't fit in economy. And, you know, he just worried about me. And I always say to people, when you're checking in on friends and family, don't just ask how they are once, you know, keep asking, because you don't know what's going on behind the smile. And he would always ask, he never wanted to leave me alone. He was always worried that I'd do something to myself. And that's what we do now. Like, you know, he helped me with no expectations of anything in return, just to help a brother. Then I had people, you know, like PJ and Alex Flint from these gyms that would just invest in me, you know, for free, just to help me. So you turn up, I'm going to help you. And that's what we do now. We're paying it forward just on a mass scale. But what we understand is not everyone has good friends and family like David Higgins that can help. You know, so if you're down in the dumps and you make a bad decision, or if life gets tough and you lose your job or whatever it is, if you don't have good friends and family, what are you going to do? You know, you're stuck, and that's when life becomes unbearable. So that's what we try and do in BBM, is be that good friends and family for others. You know, that can, if they want help, we're here.
Mm. It's interesting looking at some of your allies and then even some of the politicians that you've been involved with. They look like sort of more centre-right politicians. You know, you've got Leo Malloy and others, and you've been quite protective of when people have come out and said, oh, what are you hanging around with him for? Or, you know, why are you getting involved with Christopher Luxon or whoever it was? So is that where your politics are, or...?
Oh, look, we support whoever's going to support us, and unfortunately all these politicians are the same. Around election time, they say, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do that, and then nothing ever happens. But with my good friend Leo, every time I post a photo of him, I get hassled. Why are you friends with him? I said, well, it doesn't matter. For me, it doesn't matter what you believe in politically. It's how you are as a person. You know, are you helping others?
So what you do rather than what you say. Yeah.
It's what you know, that's it. Like, you can. I've got friends on, like, Rob is hardcore Labour. And, you know, I've got friends that are hardcore Labour, and I've got friends on the right. But they just believe in the work. So it doesn't really matter anything else. They support the work that I'm doing, you know, and that's it.
What about Chris Luxon? Did he cut you off?
Yeah.
Did you fall out of favour?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought we were friends. And...
you signed the letter, right?
Yes.
You signed the letter.
So, you know, he was coming.
Opposing racist policies.
He supported us. Yeah. He supported us through our food when our food bank got burgled. You know, privately he supported us, and he'd come and do media stand-ups at our thing. And I'd go to, national fundraising things, and, my Labour friends would go, what are you doing? Well, I've got to explore all options. But, and Chris actually said, you've got to, you know, Chris Luxon said after we were on the same plane one time, he goes, you've got to leverage everyone to get what you need for your community. And that's what it is. You have to leverage everyone to get what you need for your community. The problem was with Chris is that I signed that letter to call out racism. But what's the problem? You should call out racism, you know? And I forgot that I'd actually signed the letter. It was, you know, and then he was on the media, and it was on the news, and he said some joke, and I texted him later. So that was quite funny. Good work. And his reply was, why did you sign the letter? So I said, look, let's just catch up, you know, catch up and go over it, you know, in person. But, it's hard now. I said to him when he'd come to the radio show that I had and different things that we'd do together, and I said, you know, will I still have this access if you become Prime Minister? And he assured me I would. Hasn't worked out that way. But, you know, he has been busy, so I'll reach out. I caught up with Paula Bennett, and I said the same thing to her. I want to get in front of these people. Because what we do in BBM actually aligns more to the right in terms of the whole hand up stuff. That's what this government's going on about. Let's give this invest to give these people a hand up rather than handouts. That's everything we do in BBM.
Yeah.
You know, we are giving people handouts, hand-ups. But you've got to help them as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You've got to say, okay, let's sort your issues. Yeah. Let's give you food. You know, and then we're going to focus on getting you out of that situation.
Just a minute to go. And the obvious question, politics for you. I mean, you flirted with the idea of the Māori Party, Te Pāti Māori. Will you go into politics?
Oh, I think at some stage it's inevitable. Yeah, I've just started on the board of Te Nehe Nehe Nui, which is our Mania Poto. I'm on the charitable arm of that, just to start, you know, skilling up, schooling up in governance.
And you think it would be with Te Pāti Māori if you did do it?
More than likely, only because, you know, that'd be the party to let me be me.
And Christopher Luxon isn't responding to your texts?
No, yeah. I don't know, man. I really go over it a lot, lament it and talk to my friends, and I just think, when I announced that I was going to do it before, I had so many people saying, oh, it'll change you, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. Then I thought, but this is why we end up with the politicians we have now. You know, if every good person that has a community following is there for the people, if when they go to say, I'm going to join politics, if everyone tells them not to and they don't, you know, then that's why we don't have any good politicians.
Thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks
very much for coming in to 30. That was 30 Minutes with Dave Latelli. This is 30 with Guy and Espiner. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening. If you like this show, please remember to follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can find our other episodes on our show page, rnz.co.nz/guyon. 30 with Guy and Espiner is presented and researched by me, Guy and Espiner. The executive producer is Ali Ventura. The producer is Richard Larson. Post-production by Cole Eason-Farrelly. The audio engineer is Blair Stagpool. Our designers are Jane Joyce and Tom Crampin. Operations manager is Jamie Anan. And a special thanks to Whakaata Māori Studios.